Hello, Classical Classroom listeners. This is your host, Daisha. Just a couple of quick notes before we get started with this episode of Classical Classroom. First, if you are under the age of 18, please ask your parents if it's okay to listen to this episode of Classical Classroom because we deal with some adult subject matter. There's no cursing or anything like that, but, you know, there's some other adult themes like nudity. Anyway, make sure to do this if you are under the age of 18. Thank you. Also, if you are a regular Classical Classroom listener or a brand new one and you're super excited and you want to keep us around, go to iTunes, subscribe to us, and rate and review us. The powers that be, they see these numbers, they see your ratings and your reviews, and they say to themselves, this is an amazing show, and we should keep it around. So if that's important to you, please do it. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now, and please enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today, all the way from New York, is Victoria Bond. She is a composer and a conductor. Her work has been commissioned by organizations all around the world and the country, including the Houston Symphony. She was the first woman awarded a doctorate in orchestral conducting from Juilliard. She's guest conducted throughout the world and has been music director of the Roanoke and New Amsterdam Symphony Orchestras, among many other positions. She's been featured on the Today Show, People Magazine, and the New York Times. Victoria Bond, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
We're going to hopefully get to go over several pieces that all kind of have a historical theme. And these are all pieces that you've written. But you seem to have a particular passion for opera.
Yes, I do. My parents were both musicians, my grandparents musicians. My father sang at the New York City Opera, and when I was 7 years old, I joined the New York City Opera Children's Chorus, and that was my first job.
Wow, so this is really in your blood.
Yeah, child labor, I know, it's really cruel.
Child labor.
I got my social security number, I got to wear makeup and run around on stage and sing in a couple of different languages. It was great fun, I loved
wow.
it. And so it hooked me on opera from the start.
That's great, like just from the way back. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, I thought we would talk first about an opera that I've written called Mrs. President, which is about the first woman to run for president. That seems to be a topic that's on everybody's mind these days. And my opera is about somebody who is actually an historic figure. Her name is Victoria Woodhull.
When I first was reading about this opera, I thought that it was fiction.
Exactly.
And then realized that it was in fact a true story. So this is based on the true story of Victoria Hull.
Woodhull.
Woodhull. I'm
yes.
sorry. And she was the first woman to run for president, and it was in 1872.
Exactly, and her running mate was Frederick Douglass.
What?
Were they ahead of their time or what?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so tell me a little bit about this woman.
Very fascinating character, and the fact that she has not become a major figure in the history books, I find a really significant omission, and I'm hoping that my opera will help to right that wrong.
Yeah.
She not only ran for president, but she also was the first woman to have a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. She also had her own newspaper, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, and she was a self-made millionairess, very successful on Wall Street. She was set up in business by Cornelius Vanderbilt, and he thought it was kind of a joke. But guess what? She was very successful, made a lot of money, and was able to finance her own campaign. Mm-hmm. So here you have in the 1870s, a woman who's independent, independently wealthy, and has aspirations that go beyond, of course, what is possible because women couldn't even vote. So
right.
She is, I think, a character to really be be studied and to be known about.
Yeah, I think it's so great that you've done an opera to sort of bring this woman's story to light, because I'd never, how have I never heard of this woman before?
Well, you're not alone. I mean, yeah. Most people, when I mention her name, have not heard of her. And as I say, she deserves to be known. She was a wild woman. You know, the suffragists basically embraced her at first, and then because her ideas were so radical, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in a minute, they distanced themselves from her. So when we read about the suffragists, her name is significantly omitted.
Oh.
Now I will tell you about the controversial aspect of her life, which makes good opera. You know, I mean, a quiet, peaceful life of a school marm who runs, you know, who has some ideas, just does not make for good drama. But she was a red-hot mama. her platform included something called free love. Now, if you can imagine running on a platform of free love, you get a picture of how wildly controversial. I need to explain, though, what free love meant. It was not a 1960s love-in kind of free love. Women at that time were basically, if you want to call it, enslaved to their significant others, because they could get a divorce, but if they did, they had no right to the property, to the children. They were a pariah in society. Yeah. And so basically, even if they were in a loveless or even worse, abusive relationship, they were stuck. Mm-hmm. And she knew that because she was in a very difficult relationship with her first husband. And she heard stories of other women who really felt that they were in chains. And so free love basically meant when you fall out of love with your partner, you are free to leave. And so, you know, with that explanation, it's something that we would accept today. However, there were other aspects to her lifestyle that were very controversial, such as an open relationship, which she had with her second husband. And that was something that just did not fly in Victorian society, as you can imagine.
It was a bit much for people to take at that time.
Right,
it's a bit much for people to take now.
Exactly, exactly.
But, you know, that's interesting about the divorce, because I know people from my grandparents' generation, so not that long ago, for whom, you know, divorce was anathema. I mean, it was secret. People were socially shunned. Which is crazy to me.
Yeah,
I can imagine,
I mean,
that in 1872,
still for the Catholics, it's, you know, you have to get an annulment. You can't really get a divorce. Although with this new pope, who knows?
Yeah.
It could change. At any rate, the story hinges on her relationship with Henry Ward Beecher, another historic figure. This is all true. I'm not making this up. Henry Ward Beecher, who was the most prominent religious figure of his day, the Billy Graham, if you will, of his day. He had a church in Brooklyn, Plymouth Church, which whose congregation consisted of all of the high rollers, the moneyed people, the politicians. He was extremely charismatic, very successful, very liberal, I might add, an abolitionist. I'm sure you heard of his older sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so he was a very liberal person, talked about women's rights, but on the side, he was sleeping with his female parishioners, or at least many of them. And Victoria Woodhull found out about this because of the many women that she spoke with. Now, she wanted Henry Ward Beecher to endorse her campaign because he brought with him his flock, as it were.
Right, a lot of cash.
And she also knew that he had this extracurricular activity. So the scene, the first scene that I wanted to share with you, called Predators, is about the first meeting between Henry Ward Beecher and Victoria Woodhull.
Okay.
Now, Beecher has a younger sister, Isabella, and Isabella has been brought up to lead the proper life, be ladylike, and just follow the rules. And she meets Victoria Woodhull and is totally entranced by her and sees another lifestyle that is much more exciting and interesting to her than what she is being forced into. And so she becomes a follower of Woodhull, and her older brother, Henry, is furious at this, particularly because there have been ugly rumors spreading about his secret sexual liaisons. So in this meeting, He comes storming into her office, into her newspaper office, thinking that he is going to bully her into submission, because that is his modus operandi with most women. Mm-hmm. So you hear there's this angry, furious, fierceness to him.
Was that a little throwback to Night on Bald Mountain that I heard there?
Well, it's the same kind of, I love Mussorgsky, I always have, but there's that same kind of terrifying.
You know,
he comes in just like a storm, like a volcano, and her reaction is just the opposite. And Victoria Woodhull is not impressed with this, and she kind of laughs it off. And the sliding of the strings is, you know, just her kind of catty way of, kind of seductive. And he gets more and more angry the more laid back and seductive she is. And that little pulsing in the strings is, you know, her basically flirting with him.
I love the use of the strings.
So she's welcoming him into her office, basically drawing the net around him.
Right. No, come in, won't you?
Yes.
I am one of those near mythological creatures who will not be seduced by you. I want nothing from you but what you taught. My honor.
So he's accusing her of tarnishing his honor and dragging him through the filth of her hideous mind.
And she laughed at him.
Yeah, and he calls her a whore. I mean, he's not shy. What a whore's promise is worth.
Again, there's like a great use of the strings for that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And she says sarcastically, this must be the famous Beecher charm, because of course he has a reputation for being charismatic and charming, which is why all the women fall for him. Now, we don't know any politicians like this,
not
of course,
at all. No.
But he had this reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where he is threatening her back to the very dark, low register basses and cellos and timpani. And he builds and builds, thinking he is going to terrify her. And she says, I prefer my enemy to be seen, not to be sniping at me from hidden places. And that only makes him angrier and angrier, and he really threatens her. And you reek of hell, he says.
Ooh.
And here's where she says, you are a free lover. And he denies it, of course. And this is how she knows. She says, your female parishioners have told me all of this. I have this from reliable sources. I have witnesses. And she just sort of calmly drops the phrase that she knows about him and the story is ready to print. The story's ready to print, and all of a sudden his mood changes from bullying to panic. It's just like the blood rising and rising, rising. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do? So he goes from being the bully to groveling because he sees the possibility of his whole religious empire crumbling. And he says, what do you want? What do you want me to do? And she says, I just want you to endorse my campaign. So you confess, you are a free lover. And he's still trying to get away. That's not me, that's somebody else, that's something, somebody who comes out. And she says, it is you, don't be ashamed of it. Mm-hmm. I understand, and I don't condemn you for that. And he's never heard these words before. She says, I know that you have a loveless relationship with your wife, and that you're seeking love from whatever corner you can, and I think it's okay. I just abhor the fact that you're being duplicitous about it. So come out into the open. Let the world know you're a free lover. And this is kind of a soothing section. She realizes that she has to calm down his panic.
Right.
And all of a sudden the world opens up. You don't have to hide this anymore. You can be out in the open. Because this is my platform. This is what I'm embracing. I applaud you for being this. She says, that's what I'm about. I'm about freedom. Without that, I'd rather die. And then his mood changes again. All of a sudden, somebody has said he's not an evil person. So he has never had this kind of endorsement of his behavior. He's always hidden it and felt ashamed of it. And he says, yes, I'm a satyr. I should have lived in an earlier time when this kind of life was okay. You can free love now. How? He says.
Now they're on the same team.
And here's the hook. You support my campaign. Must I confess? You need confess nothing. And the music is just sort of drawing this magical world around him, which he's never had entree into before, mm-hmm. where he can actually be who he is without being ashamed. And that is the aphrodisiac. More than the seductress at the beginning, it's giving him the green light to be who he is.
Right.
That is the final potion. And of course, they fall for each other. And so the scene ends with them stripping off their clothing, which of course we can't do on the radio, but you get the picture. And visually they're drawing closer to each other at this point and starting to undress each other. After the high note. Can't take your clothes off when you're singing a high note.
No. It's like you can't sneeze with your eyes open.
But they whisper at the end as they get very close. Your secret stays with me is what they're whispering. I have a secret. Your secret stays with me. My secret, my secret, my secret. And by this time, they're on the floor. And that's the end of that act, the first act.
Wow.
So it looks as though she has won her point, but of course, that's only the end of Act One.
What a crafty lady that she...
Yes.
That she, you know, she... essentially blackmails him.
Absolutely.
You know, but she's also like, but you know what? It's okay.
Absolutely.
You know, so she diffuses the situation, further drawing him into her net, her web. And wow. So yeah, where does her story go from here?
Okay, so I have to back up a little bit before this scene, because Victoria Woodhull, as I mentioned, had an open relationship with her husband, and she had many lovers. Mm-hmm. And one of the other characters in this is a composite of several historic persons, okay, who we've called Joseph Treat. And Joseph Treat is a young man who had an affair with Woodhull and who is still passionately in love with her, but she's gone on. She's no longer in love with him, and she sort of brushes him off. Mm-hmm. And he brings her flowers, he tries to do everything he can to get her attention, but nothing works. And so when Victoria Woodhull and Henry Ward Beecher are going at it at the end of this scene, Joseph Treat walks in on them with a bouquet of flowers and sees them basically on the floor together. And then there's a blackout. The beginning of Act Two starts with Joseph Treat, the jilted lover, mm-hmm, writing a letter to the New York Times, to the editor of the New York Times. This, by the way, all happened in and around New York City. So he's writing a letter to the editor saying, "This woman is dangerous. She needs to be stopped. Oh. She's poisoning the family, and she's going to be giving a speech at Steinway Hall. I suggest we do something about it." So he starts the ball rolling. Then we hear Henry Ward Beecher in his study, in his library, basically saying, "What? Was I crazy? If I do this, my career is over. Right. I can't come out. I can't do this. I'll lose everybody." And so he also decides to go on the offensive against her. The next scene we see is backstage at Steinway Hall. Victoria Woodhull is giving this speech where she is going to announce her candidacy for president. And she's very nervous because Henry is supposed to be there. He's supposed to give the introduction. That was the agreement. And she's there with her mother, with Isabella, and she's nervous. Where is he? Why hasn't he come? Why hasn't he come? And it's getting later and later, and people are outside. They're chanting. They're saying, "Come on, where is she? We've been waiting out here in the rain. We paid our money." So there's a lot of pressure building up, and finally she decides, "Okay, I'm going to go out on the stage by myself, make this announcement. Maybe he'll come later. I don't know." So she goes out on the stage, and she has a prepared speech, and the crowd is not, well, they're neutral at this point.
Yeah.
It starts off with a timpani giving her heartbeats because she's very anxious, you know?
Yeah.
He was supposed to be there. He's not there. She's all alone on the stage, and she's nervous. She says, "I'm told I'm a citizen. I have every right, basically, of a citizen to participate in government. I already have the right to vote because I pay taxes. I'm part of the society." As she speaks, she gains courage because she believes in what she's saying. The interesting thing about her, yes, she blackmailed him, but she was a visionary.
Mm-hmm.
She was somebody who really had a mission. She felt she was supposed to bring this message to the world.
Yeah.
And so she says, "We pay taxes. We send our sons to war. We love, mm-hmm, and yet we're the property of men."
Mm-hmm.
Is he like chattel? Can she rape him and beat him? The law on her side? Of course, this story is still true throughout many places in the world.
Oh, yeah.
This very day, including America.
Absolutely.
And then she says, "Man and woman are one, and that one is the man."
Was that taken from something that she actually said?
I believe so. I have to give so much credit to my fabulous librettist, Hilary Bell, who is able to distill this very complex history into a really focused and powerful through line.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be difficult to take a true life story and to turn it into something.
It is. It life is messy, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't go in a straight line.
Yeah.
And she used a minimum of words, which is a blessing for a libretto. I mean, so often they're just too wordy. doesn't leave any room for the music.
Yeah, you know, I was actually, you were talking about how this is still happening in the world, and I just saw a statistic today that said that one in four girls worldwide was married before her 18th birthday.
Yeah, yeah, and some before they're 13. I mean, yeah, 10, yeah. 11, 12.
Most of those were before the age of 15.
Ugh, it's tragic. They don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. And very often to much older men.
Yeah. So this stuff that Victoria Woodhull was talking about.
Yes, you know, and she knew firsthand from her own experience. She was very young. She didn't come from a great family background. She couldn't wait to get away. So she married the first person that she thought would give her a solid lifestyle and turned out to be a disaster. He was a doctor. You know, what bad could come of marrying a doctor? Well, he wasn't there for the birth of her child, and he was an alcoholic and a womanizer and just a very weak character. Mm-hmm. And yet, after all of that, she invited him to come and live in her house when she had this big mansion in Manhattan. Mm. In this scene, she sees, as she's talking, at the back of the hall, Henry Ward Beecher come into Steinway Hall, and she thinks, oh, thank God, he's come at last, he's just late. And she motions for him to come up, and he turns his back on her. And Joseph Treat starts heckling her, saying, I understand that you live with two husbands. Well, her first husband was an alcoholic. He's the father of her child, but he was an alcoholic. And when she made all of this money on Wall Street, she bought a big house, and feeling sorry for him, she invited him to live there because he can't take care of himself. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, she remarried. And so she's got basically two husbands. And so he's heckling her about this. So the crowd is now getting riled up, and they're not in her corner. He says, Mrs. Satan, that's what you are, Mrs. Satan for president. And so between Joseph Treat and Henry Ward Beecher, they get the crowd riled up saying, Mrs. Satan, Mrs. Satan. Free love. So they're all hurling the phrase free love at her. Mm-hmm. And this really did take place at Steinway Hall. There was a Steinway Hall at that time. No more. Mrs. Satan for president.
I really called her that.
They did. Hearst's paper had a cartoon of her with black wings and horns on her head.
Wow.
Her husband tippling alcohol and a baby, and underneath it says, Mrs. Satan. I mean, she was, you know, to be the destruction of the family life as we know it.
Well, and what makes it so rich is that this was all born out of the fact that he had been her lover.
That's right.
So he was, you know, morally speaking, on the same exact ground, and he was just a spurned lover.
That's right.
Yeah.
So now she stops everybody and she hurls down her speech. Yes, I am a free lover. I have a right to love who I please for as long as I please, and to change that love every day. And then she throws her speech down on the floor and she says, there's nothing worse than a hypocrite. And then she accuses Henry, and she drags on the stage the woman who he has impregnated, just to show the crowd that she's not making this up.
Is that one person clapping?
Yeah, that's right. That's Joseph Treat. And there's that silence. It's like shock.
Because she's like spelled it out.
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, that wouldn't be acceptable today either.
Mrs. Satan for president.
a man who speaks the right words on Sunday and seduces wives.
Mm-hmm.
So now the floodgates have been opened.
What would you do to a hypocrite?
What would you do to a hypocrite? And of course, the crowd surrounds Henry Ward Beecher. They love him. And they sing a Plymouth Church hymn, which was a hymn that I wrote. They surround him, and then as a block, they move towards the stage, and they walk onto the stage, and her husband is, you know, frantically trying to get her off. I mean, they're about to do violence to her.
Yeah.
And they just start smashing and ripping things down and just trashing the whole place. And this hymn, which starts out being so stolid and solid, gets more and more crazed.
Yeah, and dissonant.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And she's trying to yell above the crowd. She's still trying to get her message across. And I've got a couple of marches in there, a little inspired by Charles Ives, whose music
sound like
I love.
Evil Who's.
Yes, yes, that's right. All made up of friendly elements, but not put together in a friendly way.
Oh, it's so creepy.
Oh, good. It's supposed to be.
The clashing of everything that's going on and in the music.
Just total chaos.
Yeah.
Just cheerful little marches, you know? But all kind of smashed together.
Yeah.
A little bit of John Philip Sousa in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the scene ends.
Whew. Wow, that was intense. This really happened to this woman.
It really happened, yes. I'm not making this up.
So Steinway Hall, filled with people who basically go from, you know, being there to attend and listen to her to, you know, magically having pitchforks in their hands.
That's right.
Coming after
ready
her.
To lynch her.
And supporting the guy who you know, supposedly was supposed to be, supposedly, let me see if I can say supposedly one more time.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be on her side.
That's right.
Wow.
And there was a trial. It was like the O.J. Simpson trial of the century. I'll set this next scene up.
Okay.
The scene is directly after this. She is lying in the arms of her husband, just almost comatose. I mean, she's just dazed. Everything that she's fought for is crumbled.
Mm-hmm.
Her ambitions are over, and she knows it. And her husband is holding her and stroking her hair and saying, you know, there's a farm, and it's out in the country, and nothing changes there but the light, and it could be yours. You don't have to do this. We can go there. We have a child. We could have a peaceful, beautiful life together. Just give up this dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a solo cello with a very folk-like melody. This was his former life. He left his former wife and child to marry her.
Mm-hmm.
Your death-defying schemes, dreams, your violence, no silence, no rest, I'm ridiculed, browbeaten, trampled on, tyrannized.
His life with her has not been a picnic.
Get in that picture.
Abused and embattled.
but happily. And everybody laughs at that line.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, my life used to be so simple. But now, you know, it's chaotic, but it's a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm. And here's where he paints for her the peaceful, quiet life that she could have. Nothing happens, nothing changes but the light.
Nothing changes but the light. They work side by side. They love as they choose.
No law, no church, no war.
This is the John Lennon portion of the opera.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
It's yours.
You can give up this craziness.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll have it, you can give it up and just be a normal person again. Again, if you never was. And it's very tender. You know, he really loves her.
Yeah.
She's really impossible to live with, but he loves her. And his voice is the cello. And she's still thinking about her dream.
Mm-hmm.
She's not quite ready to give it up yet. And she never does give it up. Which I find very inspiring. Mm-hmm. That somebody who's beaten down and beaten down and beaten down just never gives up.
Yeah.
Something I think we all need to hear.
Definitely.
He says, but we do have a child.
But we do have a child. We haven't the right to...
You know, he's pleading for her as a family person. Mm-hmm. And we all know people who have the big vision, you know, and sometimes they just let their family go.
Yeah, this is a common trope in history.
They want to save the world, but they ignore their own families.
Yeah.
If you love me, you'll stop. And she says, if you love me, you'll change. Or you'll fight. So they really are coming from two different perspectives. And she's still sort of caught in, but I want a world where all are free. You know, she's still there.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening in one corner of the stage. On the other corner of the stage, Isabella and her brother Henry Ward Beecher are having a drag-out fight.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying, how can you do this? This woman is a saint. You're murdering her. And he's saying, what are you doing to me? What about me? And he threatens her later. He says, mm-hmm. I will say that you are having an unnatural relationship with this woman, and you'll never be able to show your face in society again. And that gets her. That gets her. And this is the transition. You're murdering a saint, brother. So she's accusing him. She's shocked to find out. I mean, He was like at the right hand of God in her eye, and now she sees that he's a fraud.
Very, very human.
Yeah. She's a demon, a fiend from hell. She'd have me crucified. Rather biblical image.
Yeah.
It's
an interesting way that he's painted everything himself as the martyr.
Absolutely, it's
and
her fault.
Her as the
she tempted me, you know?
Yeah.
I never did those things. I never said that. That whore. How could you listen to her? She's poisoned your mind.
The hypocrisy
is
unbelievable.
Absolutely. And of course, in this trial, he was exonerated and she was condemned.
He was a man whore.
Of course. But it's not called a whore when it's a man, right?
Right.
It's just called, sexually active.
Yeah. Oh.
Macho.
Boys will play.
That's right.
Yes.
And then it pulls back and then we hear all four of them singing together. I love quartets. I mean, particularly in opera, you can't do this in theater.
Yeah.
But in opera, you can have each of those four strands be singing about different things, which they are, mm-hmm. and have it all blend together. And it just, I don't know, I find that one of the most thrilling things in opera.
Yeah.
And Victoria Woodhull says to her husband, "How could I have married such a small-minded man?" She realizes at this point that, you know, he doesn't get it. He doesn't have the vision. And they all say, "If you love me, have you no heart?" Would you kill what I love?
That's
all of them.
Great. They're all feeling martyred.
That's right. "If you love me" is the last words they sing. So it ends on a question. If you love me, you wouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of that scene.
Mm.
So I'll just vault to the end of the opera because I'll tell you what happens. Basically, Henry Ward Beecher sees to it that she spends election night in jail. And I am not making this up. It really happened. And the way he did it was that somebody requested her, she outed him in her newspaper. That article did come out.
Uh-huh.
And somebody, prompted by him, requested it to be mailed to him. And she was jailed for sending obscenity through the mail.
You're kidding.
No, I did not make this up.
because he was such a trusted and beloved figure.
Yes.
People thought, no way.
Exactly.
It's
he says,
libel.
She says. And obviously he says is the right is the truth. So
wow.
She spent election night in jail, and there she is alone in her cell, and she gets a letter from Isabella saying, "I wanted to follow you, I wanted to support you, but my brother threatened me, and I'm sorry, I can't."
Mm-hmm.
And so now she is abandoned by her husband, her best friend, her financial empire is in ruins, and she thinks it's all over. At that point, that is the lowest point in her life. But then, from that deep, dark, depressing pit, she thinks to herself, "Well, I may never get there, but there are going to be people that come after me, and they're going to pick up my ideas." And she sings, gradually giving herself hope. She sings, "Arise, arise from my ashes." women will come and they will pick up my ideas and they will carry them forward. And what happened in the production in Anchorage, which, by the way, was just a concert production, and we've never had a staged production yet.
Wow.
But in this concert production, there were many prominent women politicians in Anchorage, Alaska. And they came out of the wings and they walked across the stage and through the audience. And here was the living embodiment of what she had dreamed of.
Whoa.
So it's not a depressing ending. It's not over. Her ideas were picked up and they are going forward. And even though we're not there yet, we have made progress since that time.
How
so
amazing.
It ends on a very, very uplifting note.
Wow. That's incredible. And what a great idea to incorporate those women in the performance. Well, Victoria Bond, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom. This has been fascinating discussion, and I don't want it to end, but
well, to be continued then.
Definitely. I hope you come back to this show. It was great to meet you.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You'll find links to all of the ways that you can listen to us and connect with us, including, but not limited to, iTunes, Twitter, and Tumblr. However you listen to us, don't forget to rate and review us, or may the gods have mercy on your soul. Also, by the way, we have a YouTube channel if you didn't know about that. Thanks today to audio producer Todd, trusty sidekick Holslander, for making us sound nice. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for the TMI about why he's not at work today. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing forlorn puppy eyes. Thanks to Victoria Bond for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.